Alright. So this one's called Joy. Do your devotions make you happy? Is your life a joyous song? In all this talk about spiritual devotion, there is one simple fact. You have to like it. It should make you happy. It is unfortunate that so much coercion, unhappiness, bitterness, guilt, and fear become wrapped up in spirituality. Why can't we simply do things out of joy? Practicing spirituality isn't a matter of drudgery. It isn't a matter of fear. It isn't for fitting into a social group. It has nothing to do with status. Being devoted to holiness in your life is a matter of joy and celebration. When you sit down to meditate, a smile should come to your lips, and a feeling of joy should permeate your body. When you go to consecrated ground to give thanks and celebrate, you should not do so because of the day of the week or out of the habit of ritual, but because this is the best way that you know how to adore your gods and express the wonder of being on this earth. Yes, yes, there is much unhappiness in this existence. That unhappiness is part of the overall field of negativity. There are also positive things in life, and spirituality is foremost among them. So whenever we practice our spiritual devotions, let it be in gladness and joy. Meditation. Prayer. The reading's a great little segue into what I say this at some point, usually at the beginning, but I skipped it this time. So, just so it's clear to you guys, Tarek and I have other places we could be tonight. Okay? I've got 4 kids, a smoking-ass hot wife that really enjoys spending time with me. Got 7 pigs and 20 chickens and 4 goats and a bunch of shit to do around building fences and whatever else. But I've picked intentionally to come here and spend the weekend with you guys. Why? Why would anybody, not for pay, actually choose to not go do all of that? Oh, and by the way, I'm out of town most of the week, so shit doesn't get done around the farm when I'm gone. But yet I'm here. And I'm here because of what that reading talked about, is that the joy that I get out of the spiritual practice of sharing my experience is unlike anything that I can do at my house. Now, I can't do this every weekend because I don't have the energy for it. But I choose to come here with the hope that there's probably 10, 12 guys now. We've been doing these weekends for the last couple years. And there's probably 10, 12 guys now that show up at our meetings that something we said got them excited about recovery. And that is so exciting to me. Not because it's about me, because it's somebody else is getting excited about living a spiritual way of life. So for me, it's not all this ritual of this very diligent practice. Sometimes that's necessary. But like I said before, if I'm not having fun with these guys, I'm drinking. So that to me is what that reading was about. Now, what the doctor's opinion also talks about is it talks about the fact that our ideals must be grounded in a power greater than ourselves if we are to recreate our life. My life today, other than the fact that I have kids, and the fact that I have my resume, I still have the things that I did for my career, and I still have my family in my life. My life today in no way looks like my old life. Page 100, another little plug for sponsorship. First full paragraph says, both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. You do this work, you get this connection, this conscious contact. You'll hear us talk about it more as the weekend goes on. Conscious contact. This is not, for me, this is not about just getting sober and not drinking. If I don't hook up with whatever this power is that is participating in keeping me sober, I will not stay sober. It's through that conscious contact that comes in the form of intuition, comes in the form of other things, that I actually get to place orders. Like, who in here would like to be able to place orders to the universe of how they would like their life to look and actually have those things come into their life? Who in here, well, I'll just say, that is my experience. And what's really strange about it is that the things that I used to think I wanted, I no longer want. So when my ideals are connected to this power, I'll call it power so it can be more open to whatever you think it is, this energy force, this field of energy, this thing that created everything. You can call it God if you want or not. Have you ever wondered, like, okay, so there's all these laws in the universe, all these chemicals act in a specific way. and people will argue with you that there's no God. Well, what made all those laws that all those chemicals follow? Well, something did. Okay, let's call that God. Let's call whatever that is. It doesn't have to be the God that you were taught. Just whatever the thing is that made everything. Can you guys get down with that? That invented the universe, right? Even if it was a mistake, call the mistake that thing, right? So when I start to participate with that thing and my ideals are grounded in that and not me, when I live a God-centered life and not a self-centered life, things shift and change in my life. And that's what the doctor's opinion talks about. Okay?
Page 3. So let's see who fits the descriptions I'm about to go through. Because Bill's story is chopped up into two sections. The first 8 pages is Bill's drunkalogue. He describes the progression of his drinking and the consequences and the circumstances that unfolded. And then Ebby comes in and he starts talking about God. And then he talks about the recovery process. But on page 3, second full paragraph, sidebar. When I sponsor an addict through the steps, I don't read the big book like it's written for an alcoholic. I take the word alcohol out and I put in the drug of no choice. Okay? This is a textbook. We can use it that way. You know, I love working with crackheads. Crackheads are my people. I speak crackhead language. Right? The big book says that once we've worked the steps, we're going to be properly armed with facts about ourselves. And we can generally win the entire confidence of another addict or alcoholic in a few short hours. I can win the confidence of a crackhead. Hell, I won yours right there at the coffee pot in like 15 seconds. Because I said something to him that only two crackheads would understand. All right? So I can win the confidence of a crackhead just like that. It takes me a little bit longer with the meth addict, even longer with the heroin and the opiate addict. Very difficult for me to work with pill poppers, but I can win the confidence of an alcoholic in a few hours. But I'm really effective with cocaine addicts, and I enjoy working with cocaine addicts because we've been to the same places. And they are intrigued when I describe being where they've been, and I haven't been there in a long time. Right? Identification, vital for this process. So on the bottom of page 3... it says, my drinking or using assumed more serious proportions. It continued all day and almost every night. Who fits that? Everybody get to that place in here, drinking or using? The pleading objections, that's what remonstrances means, of my friends terminated in a quarrel or an argument, and I became a lone wolf. Who here fit that description?
Wolf pack of one?
Yeah. There were many unhappy scenes in my home. Who fits that description? All right, so we've all progressed there. All right, so now we're going to turn to page 5. First full paragraph. For me, cocaine. For you, it could be heroin, meth, whiskey, vodka, whatever it is. It wasn't a luxury anymore. It became a damn necessity. I had to have it to breathe. I had to have it so I didn't have to deal with myself. Anybody fit that?
Yep.
All right, skip a few paragraphs down to the bottom. I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not take so much as one hit off the stem. I could not so much as take one drink. I was through forever. Anybody experienced that?
Oh, yeah.
How many of you have quit for good? Okay. All right, let's turn the page. Page 6. The remorse, horror, hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending disaster. Where are my tweakers at? Okay. I'm going to tell you all a story that Brandon loves. So near the end of my crack smoking days, because I wasn't sleeping, it used to take me about 3 or 4 days of staying up before the green men would show up and the shadow people would show up. And the voices would start. Near the end of my crack smoking, I was smoking crack for like a half hour and the voices were starting. And I was having psychosis. And so there was I don't remember how many days I'd been up. I was convinced people were coming into my house. And I heard them walking around the house, and so I decided to gather all my belongings and go down into the unfinished part of the basement. And there was a big refrigerator box that was not being used, and I wanted to hide, so I crawled into the box with my cell phone, my crack, and my crack stem, and I sat in this refrigerator box smoking crack, sweating profusely for hours. All right, this is where it had taken me. So every time I read this paragraph, the remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a sense of impending calamity. This is what I felt like that at the end of that experience. I remember saying to myself, I want this shit to be over. How the fuck did I just spend like 2 or 3 hours in a fucking box smoking crack?
The description was lacking, because usually you say, I'm in there in my underwear. Like, you know, it's like I'm going to take all this stuff, but no clothes, right?
This is where my addiction had taken me. But the messed up part, I mean, it was another year or so before I reached my surrender. Man, but if you had plugged a lie detector test up to me coming out of that experience, I was done. I remember getting my shoebox with all my stems and everything in it and throwing that shit away. Right? And then I'm at the gas station a couple days later doing it again. So I don't know if you guys got to that place. And then page 8. This is my progression.
Let me interrupt real quick. So on page 4, it talks about the papers reported men jumping to the death from the towers of high finance. That disgusted me. Bill is disgusted with these people that are willing to kill themselves, right? So, page 6, 2 pages later, he asks himself, should I kill myself? No, not now. He's considering it now. Used to be judgmental of the people that did it. Now he's considering it. One paragraph later, again, I sway dizzily before an open window or the medicine cabinet where there was poison, cursing myself a weakling. He was at the point now where he wanted to do it, but couldn't do it. And then at the bottom of page 7, the doctor's telling his wife that he would soon need to be turned over to the undertaker. They did not need to tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. So there's a different way that it shows the progression, right? Is he's judging people for wanting to kill themselves. He's getting to the point of maybe considering it, to the point of wanting to do it, to the point of praying for it. Mm-hmm. You'll hear a little bit more about that, but anybody ever get to that place? Anybody live through it? I hope so, because you're here, right?
Here's another sidebar. This just came into my consciousness. When I'm in an AA meeting, I don't talk about my experience with cocaine. I limit my discussion to alcohol. And I have drank for 17 years, and I have loss of control, and I have some mental handicaps when it comes to the first drink. But I respect singleness of purpose. You know, the cool thing about doing these weekends with me and Brandon was we throw singleness of purpose out the window, because look at our audience. The majority of you are drug addicts. And so we have to win your confidence. So I got to share all my stories with you. I spent a lot of time in CA. You know, Cocaine Anonymous is all mind-altering substances, so you can talk about whatever you want, and we use the big book. HA is just heroin, but they use the big book. CMA is crystal meth, but they use the big book. Right? So it's really important you guys get this, because here's what I've seen. Is people go to AA, and the old-timers don't want us talking about drugs and AA, which I respect. But if you're not an alcoholic and you raise your hand and introduce yourself as an alcoholic, because the treatment centers tell you if you're one, you're automatically the other, which is not true. And on some level, you're living a lie, because you're saying, hey, my name's Tarek. Assuming I was an alcoholic, if I say I'm Tarek, I'm alcoholic, I've just started down a path of rigorous honesty called the 12 steps, and I'm starting it with a fundamental lie, right? So let's assume that you're in an area where there's only AA meetings. Well, introduce yourself as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because they go by the short form of the third edition, which says that the only requirement is a desire not to drink. Just because you're not an alcoholic doesn't mean you're not powerless over alcohol like you are powerless over your drug of no choice, but alcohol will still take you back to your drug of no choice eventually. It doesn't mean we're giving you a green light. Just find out what you are. And so introduce yourself as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if the meeting happens to be about the first half of the first step, maybe you refrain from sharing. But anything after that, it's the same. Unmanageability, step two, step three, step four, step five. Talk about the experience of working the 12 steps. You guys understand what I'm saying?
And I'll speak at Cocaine Anonymous meetings. There's been no form of cocaine that I'm aware of that has ever entered my body.
Yeah.
So I introduced myself as a member of Cocaine Anonymous. I'm not doing anything wrong.
Okay. Page 8. Surrender. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter swamp of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I'd met my match. I'd been overwhelmed. Crack cocaine was my master. That's my surrender. That's my experience right there. That's the progression. But here's the turning point. Do you believe you've met your match, that you've been overwhelmed, or do you still think there's something you can do to keep yourself sober and protect yourself from your buddy? Whatever your buddy is, cocaine, meth, heroin, vodka, whiskey, whatever it is. That's an important question you have to answer for yourself before you can set out to do what's on page 13. So Bill was in town's hospital for the third or fourth time. He's in DTs. He's in detox. Ebby comes to visit him. Bill's like, Ebby, what's that neat formula you were trying to talk about when we met earlier? It's the 6 steps of the Oxford group. And they started working the steps while Bill was in the detox. And Bill was still struggling with God. And one night, Bill's sitting in his hospital room, still in detox. And he says, if there is a God, show yourself to me. And the room lit up, and a breeze came running through the room, and Bill was convinced that was God. And the next day he runs to Dr. Silkworth and says, hey, I want to talk to everyone else in the hospital. I think I've got something. I want to talk about what happened to me last night. And Silkworth says to Bill, there's definitely something different about you. I don't know what it is, but you better hold on to it, because anything's better than how you were yesterday. And as Bill sat in his hospital room, he got this idea of helping others. And so here's the process him and Ebby worked through. Top of page 13, at the hospital, I was separated from alcohol for the last time. Treatment seemed wise, for I showed signs of DTs. There, I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood him. Step 3, to do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without God I was lost. I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my newfound friend, God, take them away, root and branch. Steps 4, 5, 6, and 7. I love how they reference the defects of character as roots and branch. For most of us, we don't want the defects gone. We want the consequences from the defects gone. We still want to do this shit because we're still getting something from it. We just don't want to get caught. We don't want the consequences. But this says root and branch. To me, the branch is the consequence. The root's the actual grosser handicap. I have not had a drink since. Ebby visited me. I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies. Step 5. I made a list of people I had hurt and toward whom I felt resentment. Steps 4 and 8. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals admitting my wrongs. Step 8. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to right all such matters to the utmost of my ability. Step 9. Are you willing to do what I'm talking about? What Bill's describing here, this is what it takes to consummate this process. I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Step 10, common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. Step 11, never was I to pray for myself, except as my request bore on my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure. My friend Ebby promised that when these things were done, conditional, right? You ain't getting the rest unless you do what's ahead, before it. My friend promised when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, a spiritual awakening, that I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems, not the drug and the alcohol problem only, all my problems. Belief in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were the essential requirements. Simple, but not easy. A price has to be paid. It means destruction of self-centeredness. Would you guys agree that when I hear the word destroy, or something has been destroyed or gone through a destructive process, that it's dead on some level? Yeah? There's a concept I've been working with. You know, we get these newcomers come to us, and we spend a lot of time talking about, do you want to live? Do you want to breathe? I want to talk about, are you willing to die before you die? So I'm going to read something. Besides the fear of pain, there's another fear, which has to be faced on the path of evolution, the fear of death. Every new form is born out of a dying old form. This process of dying to live is represented by organic life. Inorganic matter becomes organic by dying to itself and living a higher life in the plant, and so can the plant be exalted into still higher life by dying unto itself and living in the animal. The whole course of evolution is an illustration of the principle of dying to live. Can the seeker or the 12-step worker easily give up the old organs in order to acquire new ones? Can we learn to surrender to the demand? Die before you die. Die inside this life and go on living this life, advocates Rumi paradoxically. His view of death as a prerequisite for birth encompasses the whole range of possibilities open to him who desires to live as a true human being. The soul of such a one knows no limits. In verses often quoted, he exclaims, I died as a mineral and became a plant. I died as a plant and rose to animal. I died as animal and I was man. Why should I fear? When was I less by dying? Yet once more I shall die as man, to soar with angels blessed. But even from angelhood I must pass on. All except God do perish. When I have sacrificed my angel soul, I shall become what no minds ever conceived. Oh, let me not exist, for non-existence proclaims in organ tones, to him I shall return. The soul and the spirit ascend the ladder of evolution with the power of love. On every step, it is reminded of the vast free spaces of home where the beloved abides. The remembrance of the old, forgotten taste of the homeland, the real homeland, gives the soul and the spirit the courage to die to the known and to leap into the unknown. The lament of separation then turns into a song of jubilation. And that is what keeps us from making this transition, is this thing that we're leaping into the unknown. But part of leaping into the unknown is you got to ask yourself, am I willing to die the death of self? Am I willing to die of doing it my way? My plans and designs do not work. I cannot keep myself clean and sober. Am I willing to stop trying to do things the way I've always done them? Am I willing to completely submit to a way other than my own? Am I willing to turn my life over to my sponsor? Am I willing to die? There are things about each of us in this room that must die for new character attributes to be born. That's what this is about. So when the book says simple but not easy, a price has to be paid, it means destruction of self-centeredness. The 12-step process will tear chunks of you away. It will annihilate parts of you, and new things will be born. That's the most fascinating part of this entire process. And as sponsors, it is incumbent upon us who become sponsors to help our sponsees die. We give them a clear set of instructions to help them die, the death of self, so they can have a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery. That's what this whole thing is about. And I've been stressing for years, do you want to live? Do you want to breathe? I should have been asking him, are you willing to die before you die? And here's the dilemma. Most of you sitting in this room don't want to die. Not the death of self. Not the way of doing it the way you want to do it. That's what has to die in order for you to be reborn. The third step promises talk about it. If you keep close and perform His work well, you will be born. Reborn means something has to die in order to be reborn. So these are revolutionary and drastic proposals. But the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. There was a sense of victory followed by such a peace and serenity as I have ever known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up as though the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, but His impact on me was sudden and profound. I've had all those things happen to me on this spiritual path. Great confidence. Feel like the wind blew through and through. A sense of victory. An electric effect. Yes, all of that has happened to me on this path. Because I have given myself to this path by the grace of God. He's delivered me to it. And for a moment, I was alarmed. I called my friend, "What the hell, Doc?" to ask if I were still sane. He listened in wonder as I talked. Finally, he shook his head saying, "Something's happened to you. I don't understand, but you had better hang on to it. Anything is better than the way you were." While Bill lay in the hospital, the thought came that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what he had been so freely given. Perhaps he could help some of them. They, in turn, would work with others. Ebby emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Particularly is it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works is dead, he said, and how appallingly true for the addict and alcoholic. This is one of the most important lines in the book. If Tarek and Brandon fail to perfect and enlarge their spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, us coming down here this weekend, me setting aside time to meet with sponsees, I'm not going to survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. They just promised you trials and low spots. Struggle. It's coming for every single person sitting in this room. If we do not work, we will surely get high or drink again. If we drink and get high again, we're surely going to die. If we fit the description of the addict and alcoholic in the big book, then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. I grow spiritually through work and self-sacrifice. And so a question I'll leave you with before I turn it over to Brandon is, what are you willing to sacrifice for personal recovery? What are you willing to kill off? Are you willing to die in this life so you can have this life?
That's a big break.
When that part where it says when he's laying in the hospital, is that when you first thought of AA?
That's when he came up with the idea that, man, this is really cool what just happened to me. What if I go help other people have the same experience? So what Bill realized was that God was the solution and he had the six steps, but he wasn't explaining the problem. Once he left Helen's hospital, he was just trying to shove those six steps and God down Wino's throats, and it didn't work until he saw Silkworth, and Silkworth said, you know what, maybe you should explain to them why they're hopeless. Maybe if they see the hopeless condition, then they'll be willing to listen. So, did I answer your question, Pappy? We're going to break, and then Brandon's going to tell his story over at the podium. And so we'll be in the pews for the last session, and then we'll call it a wrap.